I'm going to begin the Bible study here with questions that are left over and from in the past. This was an interesting one, and it won't be long before Passover comes up here on Sunday night, the 13th of April this coming year. What part of the Passover service did Judas Iscariot take part in? Ruth, you know? You got that figured out yet? You're right. As best as we understand, I say that as best as we can understand, because let's go through the four, quickly, the four scriptures that would cover this. Matthew 26, we'll just take them in order. Matthew 26 account of that last Passover. And Bruce here mentioned the foot washing, he thought, and of course that's what we've always thought, and I believe that's true and is will be borne out here, although it does not directly state it. That's the thing. And so let's take a look at this, if I get there. All right. In Matthew 26, the last Passover account, let's just go to verse 21 to start there. Now as they were eating, now this of course is the Passover meal that had been prepared. This is not the taking of the bread. Now, where is it? Verse 21. Now as they were eating, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful. And each of them began to say to him, "Lord, is it I?" And then he answered and he said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be have been good for that man if he had not been born." Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, interesting, betraying him. He already had agreed to betray him. "Rabbi, is it I?" And he said, "You have said it." Okay, now here's a little break. Because in verse 26, now we go into the bread and the wine. He did not tell them in advance, "By the way, tonight, fellows, this Passover will be different than the previous three that I've had with you, in that after the meal, or during the meal, actually, to be more precise, I am going to introduce a new symbols for you to carry on after I'm gone." Nothing like that was said. In other words, he tells them, he does this, you might say, by surprise. Not that he was trying to shock them or anything, but that it wasn't previously, we have no record that they knew this was coming up, okay? The reason I explained that is because you find in Matthew's account, at the end of verse 25, where is Judas before verse 26 starts? The implication is, as you will see, that he's not there, that he will have left. We'll see as we go through all four accounts, okay? Now, so Matthew does not tell us, he only tells us that Judas said, "Is it I?" And that's it. That portion of the evening stops there. Now, at some time after that is when Jesus then, while they're all sitting around a table, by the way, and had their meal, he will then, of course, do the foot washing and presumably, by the way, that leads to another question that when I'm looking at this made me think again. Why didn't the first three gospel writers include the foot washing or make some mention of it? I don't know why. It is John, 60 years later, who spends in quite detail the episode of the foot washing and how Peter at first refused to let Christ do it, all of those things. And it's quite interesting, but it was not recorded in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. All right, so Matthew tells us, Jesus said, "One of you is going to betray me." And Judas asked, "Is it I?" He said, "You have so spoken." And all right, that's where it stops. Now let's go to Mark 14. Mark 14. And verses 18 through 22. Where is it? 18, 18. Where are you? There we go. "Now as they sat and ate, Jesus said, 'Assuredly, I say to you, one of you who eats with me will betray me.' They began to be sorrowful and to say to him one by one, 'Is it I?' And another said, 'Is it I?' And then he answered and said to them, 'It is one of the 12 who dips with me in the dish.'" Well, all 12 did. So that didn't answer the question. It's not just Judas alone who did it, dipped in the dish. And the son of man, in, because they pass the dish is what they did, and as they pass it, they dip. And let's see, the son of, verse 21, but the son of man, well, that's a repeat there. Well, okay, it stops at the end of verse 21. Now, Mark records really the exact same thing that Matthew recorded, and Mark's account stops on this portion of it at the end of verse 21. Then verse 22, he goes into the unleavened bread and the wine. Okay, so again, the portion in which he talks about one betraying him is before the bread and the wine, isn't it? All right, let's go to Luke's account. Luke's account. Okay, we got so far two for two before the bread, giving of the bread and the wine. What about Luke's account, though? Now, notice in Luke's account in verse chapter 22, chapter 22 of Luke, verse 14 through 20 is the taking of the bread and the wine, specifically 19 through 20. But then look at what Luke does after he records the giving of the bread and the wine that Christ introduced. Verse 21, but behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. All right. Well, that, what does that mean? Well, they were eating a dinner and it was on a table. Okay. It doesn't necessarily mean here that it was after the taking of the bread and the wine. All right. Verse 22, and truly the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man. Of course, that's repeated from the others. Then they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. And that's it. So in Luke's account, these three verses, 21 through 23, he puts after the bread and the wine. Matthew and Mark put it before the bread and the wine, didn't he? Who's right? Well, let's go to John's account. John chapter 13, I should say. John 13, the foot washing. And what can we learn from this? So far, we have two out of three before the bread and the wine. And I think I can tell you something about Luke. Both Mark and Luke were not firsthand there. They are receiving their information. Commentaries tell you that Mark received most of his information on his gospel that he wrote from Peter. Luke was receiving, he quotes Mary a couple times in the early pages of the book of Luke. Of course, a lot of it was what was handed down and given that was even firsthand right after the church was formed. I covered that last year before the days of unleavened bread and Passover as to it wasn't something that was decades later. It was very much information right up to date. Now let's look at John. John was there, wasn't he? As Matthew was there. Okay, John 13:1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Verse 2. And supper being ended, as that's incorrect, as every year at Passover I usually comment and mention that. The supper, during the supper is what the Greek actually says, during the supper, not after it was over with. Now, what supper? See, the unleavened, the institution of the unleavened bread and the Passover is not the supper. Now, I know that the various Protestants call it the Lord's Supper and all of that, but that is something that they mistake from 1 Corinthians 11 about verse 20 or 21 there, the only place where that term is used in the Bible. That's another story there in itself. But during the Passover supper that the apostles went in advance to prepare for, as you recall the story, in this upper room of this individual's, his home or building that he had. All right, so then you have the foot washing. During supper, he begins to get up and go around and wash their feet. Now, there was a table that they were eating supper from, right? Okay, now we go through, and Peter, you know this, I don't want to read all of this now, but I'm going to drop down to verse 21. Then Jesus, after washing their feet, had said these things. He was troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Okay. Now this turns out to tell us that Judas is there for the foot washing. He hasn't left yet, as you're going to see in another few verses. He is there for the foot washing. Okay. Verse 22, then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom he loved, which was John. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was whom he spoke of. Then leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, "Lord, who is it?" And Jesus answered, "It is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it." And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot. Well, they also, I think the other accounts show that the others also were receiving it. That didn't tell them a whole lot. Unless in John's account, this was specifically only to Judas. Verse 27, now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him, and Jesus said to him, What you do, do quickly. But no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. For some thought, because Judas had the money box that Jesus had said to him, "Buy those things that we need for the feast," or that he should give something to the poor. Verse 30, having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately. Now this is why the church has always believed he was there for the foot washing, but not there for the bread and the wine. That would come after this, at some portion after he had left. Verse 31, so when he had gone out, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him," through this betrayal that was going to take place. So really, even though Luke's account, he simply is recording it, he did not put it in the order that it actually took place. And Matthew and Mark, because of what we read in John, but have it more in order, that the statement that one of you will betray me was before the bread and the wine. All of this was done at the Passover meal that they were having that night. And so he got up, he washed, as we read here in chapter 13, the disciples' feet, including Judas, because Judas was still there after the foot washing's over. And then he leaves immediately after this. That's the only thing that tells us. I told you before, remember there's a gap in Matthew and Mark's account. It comes to an end, one of you will betray me, and then it stops, and then we go to the next subject, which is suddenly the giving and the blessing of the bread and then the blessing of the wine. What happened between those two in time and event at the table that night? Well, this is what happened. And so... to answer your question, I hope I have anyhow, we believe and have always felt and taught because of this, Judas did partake or was involved in the foot washing, but not in taking of the bread or the wine. He had already left and gone to betray Christ. Then Christ introduced the bread and the wine to the rest of the disciples and to the church for the future. Okay, that one. After baptism, the minister asks the Father to give his spirit to the one who is just baptized, laying on of hands. That's correct. Romans 8, verse 9, if a person does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not or does not belong to Christ. When do we receive the Spirit of Christ as we officially receive the Spirit of the Father after baptism? It is the same, one and the same, because Jesus Christ is God. He is the Son of God. He is God. Remember John 1:1? And there's not two separate spirits. It is not wrong to call it the Spirit of Christ, as Paul did there in Romans chapter 8, verse 9, as you cite. It is the same Spirit that is given upon repentance, baptism, and the prayer with the laying on of hands. Where was Daniel when his three friends were thrown into the furnace? I don't know. If you ever find out, let me know. The Bible doesn't say. So that's an easy one to answer, actually. Let's go now to Daniel chapter 8, and where we will pick up here in the Bible study here today. And I do have a, when you get to Daniel 8, I have a question on Daniel 7. Let me get over here. And then we'll get actually into Daniel 8. Okay. In Daniel 7 is a question from last time. I had made the statement that Jesus Christ was the Son of Man, Daniel 7:13, and that the Ancient of Days, Daniel 7:13 and 14, was God the Father. One of three places in the Old Testament showing that there are two in the God family, or Godhead, as we've used that term. The other one is in Psalm 45, and then the third one is in Psalm 110. The question, Daniel 7:22, it says the Ancient of Days is Christ, not God the Father. Please explain. Well, that's correct. It does say that. I thought one of the best, I have here the Expositor's Bible Commentary. I'm not going to use it to answer this question because it gets kind of wordy into the Trinity type subject on this, trying to explain that it is, explain away what is very clear. Now, it does call the Ancient of Days in the Expositor's God, but I liked the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown Commentary on the whole Bible, which I have, because it just, you know, got right to the point and made it very clear. The title, if you're there in Daniel 7, verse 22, 21, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Yes, it is referring there in verse 22 to Christ as the Ancient of Days in that verse. All right, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The title applied to Father in verse 13 of this same chapter is here applied to the Son, who is called the Everlasting Father in Isaiah 9, verse 6. The Father is never said, and this is the important thing I thought was very interesting about their commentary, the Father is never said to come. It is the Son who comes. Let's go back here. Look at verse 13 and 14. I was watching in the night visions. Behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him, and then to him was given dominion, and so on. Good point that was made, I thought, here by that, that the Father is never said to come. It is the Son. It is the Son who comes. Interesting about chapter 7, verse 13. Verse 22 here, judgment. And a judgment was made in favor of the saints. Judgment includes rule. Kingdom, and the end of this verse, Christ first receives judgment and the kingdom, and finally, then the saints with him. In verse 13 and 14 in parentheses here. In verse chapter 7, verse 13, coming on the clouds, this is from the Expositor's Bible Commentary, commenting on coming with the clouds of heaven in verse 13. Let me, to save time, just give you three scriptures in the Gospels about that, where Christ himself said he comes in the clouds. So it's obviously meaning that the Son of Man, remember, Jesus Christ always used the term when they ask him, who are you? I'm the Son of Man. And in the book of John, multiple times, the term Son of Man is used. It didn't offend anybody. Now, finally, it was in the last 6 months between Feast of Tabernacles and the spring Passover of his last year before he actually began to be more explicit to the public on being the Son of God. Now, here's three quick verses, and then we'll get into chapter 8 for today. Mark 13, verse 26, Christ said, literally, I will come on the clouds, in the clouds. Mark 13, 26. Matthew 24, 30. These are both Olivet prophecies, by the way, in Matthew's account, Matthew 24, 30. How is he going to come? In the clouds. Why is it important to have those scriptures? Because it tells you who the Son of Man is in Daniel 7, verse 13. No question about who the Son of Man is. The commentaries know it. expositors, as well as Jameson, Foss, and Brown, clearly know the Son of Man is Christ. And the third one is in Matthew 26 and in verse 24, where he says that. One other thing just to add to Daniel 7:13, the expression Son of Man. Remember from previous Bible studies that the book of Daniel is not all in Hebrew. From chapter 2 to chapter 7 is Aramaic or Chaldean. Okay? So we're still in the Aramaic Chaldean language of that day. Son of Man is Aramaic in chapter 7, and it is in the Aramaic language Bar-Nas, B-A-R, space, Nas, N-A-S. Its Hebrew equivalent is Ben-Adam, Ben-Adam, and is used here as a divine personage, as divine personage. And the Hebrew equivalent to Bar-Nas is Ben-Adam, used. And that term Ben-Adam is used for in the book of Ezekiel extensively, and referring, of course, to the one who would later become Christ. Okay, I think I've covered everything there. Let's go to chapter 8. Check my time. Don't want to hold you up for dinner, right? Especially the cleanup crew. That's the important thing. All right, let me get into this here. In the third, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. What was the first time? You go back, chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar. Now we are 2 years later, in the third year of Belshazzar. When was the first and third years of Belshazzar? Well, he became co-regent with his father in about 553, so the third year would probably be 550 B.C. And just for information, in chapter 5, notice these chapters are not in order, because Daniel assembled this book around 530 at the end of his life. Now, some of these things may have been written along the way, but he puts it all together before his death, basically, at the almost at coming to the end of the 6th century, around, they estimate, around 530 to 535 B.C. Now, in chapter 5, Belshazzar doesn't apparently know who Daniel is, because the mother queen had to tell him when he saw the handwriting on the wall. I'm just going to, without reading all this, just reviewing it. And that night, he died. Darius the Mede and his group came under the gates over the Euphrates River, were able to slip up to the palace and kill him during the celebration to Marduk or whatever else the gods that they had at that time. when was that? That was in October of 539. Okay, just kind of get this in space in your mind. Now, come back here. Chapter 8, verse 1, probably is about 550. Give or take 1 or 2 years, 550 B.C. And Belshazzar has about 11 years to live before he will be killed by Darius the Mede. At this time, Daniel is receiving visions from God about things for the future, but he is not known by the king. Whereas previously, he's interpreted the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and Nebuchadnezzar had elevated him to second in the kingdom, didn't he? Because he could not only tell what it meant, but tell what it was that he dreamed and saw in his dream. So for that, he was elevated to a very, very high position. Now at the end of chapter 5, after he told Belshazzar what the dream meant, or the handwriting on the wall meant, he was elevated to third in the kingdom. And the reason why was because Belshazzar was second in the kingdom. His father, Nabonidus, who was not mentioned by Daniel, he was the actual king in supreme authority, Nabonidus. But his son was co-regent because Nabonidus was out of town, getting ready to fight Cyrus the Great, and trying to develop an allegiance with the Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt. Now, as we come into chapter 8, here we begin to get into the second great kingdom. That is the kingdom of the Medo-Persians. Cyrus the Great came into power, just to give you some history here. In 558, Cyrus became the king of Persia. And they were not united with the Medes. The Medes were an enemy. Around 550 BC, about 3 years later, Cyrus defeated the king of Media. And then those who followed after him, they became in an alliance with the Persians. And so it became the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, Nabonidus, he was calculating a little bit. Now, since he defeated the king of Media, and now the Medes are joined with him, and they become one kingdom, what am I going to do here? I'm standing alone. So I better talk to Egypt and Lydia, which is Asia Minor or Turkey, and we better see if we get a pact together to protect ourselves. He is running all over the place. As we're going to see from the expositor's Bible commentary, Cyrus the Great did run all over the, you might say, the known world at that time. Okay, just a little bit, let's move on. So I saw, verse 2, in the vision, and so it happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, or Susa, which is the capital of Persia. Notice it's not Babylon. Now Shushan, or Susa, the ruins of that, were southeast of Babylon, and in today what is Iran. And Persia would be Iran today. The citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. I'm probably not saying that right, but anyhow, that is not a river. It's a canal connecting two rivers outside of the capital city of Susa. And then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and two horns were high. But one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Persia. Persia was greater than Media. And yes, it came up last because it defeated the Medes, and it became a ram with two horns. But the superior horn was the latter one, the higher one, or Persia. Verse 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will, and he became great. Cyrus the Great went west all the way into Europe, into Greece and Macedonia, in those areas. He took all of Asia Minor, which is Turkey today. He went up into what is Russia today. He went all the way between the Caspian and the Aral Sea, or Aral Sea in southern Russia. He took on the Scythians, which were part of the, by this time, 200 plus years have gone by since the northern nation of the Israelites had gone into captivity. Many of those people, of those Scythian tribes, were actually of some of the tribes that were taken captive and had multiplied in 200 years. And one of his biggest battles was with the Scythians, and he did struggle with them, although he apparently held his own from what I was reading here. He also took everything going east to the Indus River in India. And so that was a pretty big power grab of territory. And the Persians held on to it for over 200 years before the coming of Alexander the Great. He will eventually take Egypt. He did not take Egypt at first, but he did after he took Babylon. Then later he goes and he takes Egypt. So he took everything west in all four directions. Coming back here to verse 6. Then he came to, verse 5. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. He's very fast. He's really moving. Nothing is in his way. It's Alexander the Great, as verse 21 will tell you. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, Alexander the Great. Then, you notice one's a ram and the other's a goat. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. and I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns, Media and Persia. And there was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Alexander the Great defeated in about 331 B.C. The Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire had some great notable people during its time. One was Xerxes the Great in about 485 in that period of time. You know who his queen was? Esther. The Book of Esther was the queen of Artaxerxes the Great of Persia. Who? What did he do that kind of put him in the history books? He crossed the Bosporus Dardanelles to attack the Greeks. And an individual whose name I don't remember ran 26 miles to tell that the Greeks had crossed the Bosporus Dardanelles, and then he dropped dead of a heart attack. And from that we have the marathon. That's true. That's how we got the marathon. From that Greek runner who was running to tell the Greek general, whoever it was, that the Persians had crossed the Dardanelles. And that was that Greek leader was Xerxes the Great. Coming back here, let's see, verse 9, verse 8. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Alexander, after he defeated the Persians in 331, died in 323, either of a fever or of an assassination. I've heard and read both, and I'm not sure if anyone really knows for sure. You know, there's only two books or records of Alexander the Great that we have from history. And both of them were written 400 years after his death. That's interesting because you know how people want to pick the Bible apart? They don't pick those two accounts of Alexander the Great's life, that he did exist. They question whether people of the Old Testament, New Testament really existed. You know how much there is written about them? You have to realize that the Bible is not just one volume. It is many books written over 1,000 years of time by multiple authors, 40 different authors. And yet here you have people want to doubt, for example, did King David exist? They don't doubt whether Alexander the Great existed. The only thing they have on Alexander the Great are two books written by two Greeks, I believe it was, who wrote over 400 years after his death. And that's all we have. Nothing from his period of time when he lived. Anyhow, that's a little on the side there just to point out. There's no question about that when it comes to something that is secular, but anything that has to do with the Bible, oh, we got to question that they do. All right, coming back here, notice that he dies. That's what it's talking about. The large horn was broken, and in its place, four notable ones came up. And you're going to see the interpretation later in this chapter. Gabriel will come to Daniel and give this to him. I'm kind of giving some of this to you in advance of reading it. The four notable ones, his generals, then divvied up the kingdom. It took him about 7 years and several battles to finally get it all settled. One of them was Ptolemy. He is a Greek man, a Greek general, and he took over Egypt, which included what today would be Libya, the Benghazi area, Silesia, the port, the city he had built there was the, can't think of it right now, it's in the Book of Acts, who came from Cenchrea, I wish I had my maps open so I could, my mind just goes blank. But anyhow, the Greeks built a Greek city in that portion of Libya. Egypt was not the boundaries of Egypt that you see today. It went to the Sudan and to Ethiopia, as well as west into Libya. And Somebody say it's in Korea? Cyrene, that's it. Who was it was from Cyrene in the book of Acts? That's it, yeah. Who carried the cross and everything. Of Cyrene. That was a Greek-built city of North Africa in what today is very close to Benghazi in Libya. All of that was the territory of Ptolemy. The other one that you'll find, and he will be the king of the south when we get into chapter 11, the king of the north will be Seleucid. Seleucid will make Babylon his capital, and he will control everything from Lebanon all the way to the Indus River. That's a big chunk to be able to control. The other two, I have them written down here. I have them in this book account that I'm going to start reading from a little bit to show you, because out of one of them, out of the king of the north, will come an individual whose name and title will be Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And I want to read a little bit about him as we go forward there. The other two of the four generals who divided up Alexander's kingdom, one got Turkey, the other one got Macedonia and Greece, okay? And they were separated by the Bosporus and Dardanelles is what the natural border was between them. They don't play any more significance in Bible prophecy. But you will see that Seleucid and Ptolemy and their descendants do. Cleopatra is the last of the Ptolemies. She is Greek. You know, Mark Antony, Cleopatra, and all of that they made movies out of and things like that. All right. Let me come back here. Now, verse 9. And out of one of them, and it will be the king of the north, Seleucid, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now this is talking, first of all, in this chapter of Antiochus Epiphanes, the first abomination of desolation, prophesying. Daniel is given this the third year of Belshazzar. It's 550 B.C. He is given this prophecy. When will it be fulfilled the first time? 168 B.C. Almost, what, four centuries will go by before the prophecy will be fulfilled the first time. But as we will see as we get to the end of this chapter, there is a second time that Antiochus is a type of that which would come in the time of the end, that Jesus Christ in the Olivet prophecy said, when you see the abomination of desolation prophesied by Daniel the prophet, Matthew 24, verse 15, showing that it had to happen a second time. Okay, now let me just fill in here real quickly, and I'll try to keep cognizant of the time here to move along. Some of the information that is given here. I can find it. Here we go. Verses 9 through 12 foretell the rise of a small horn from the midst of these four horns. It is described as attaining success in aggression against the south, or the domains of the Ptolemies in Egypt, which it did. He invades Egypt as well. This suddenly refers to the career of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who usurped the Seleucid throne from his nephew, son of his older brother, Seleucid IV, and succeeded in invading Egypt in 170 and 169 B.C. His expeditions against rebellious elements in Parthia, which was controlled, as Josephus tells us, by tribes of the northern Israelites who had grown in Parthia, and Armenia, which is where they were taken, right, when they, if you read 2 Kings 17, were initially successful to the east, as well as his determination to impose religious and cultural uniformity on all his domains led to a brutal suppression of Jewish worship in Jerusalem and generally throughout Palestine. Here, in this verse, referred to as the beautiful land, or adornment, or pride, or glorious land, as it is translated in New King James. The suppression came to a head in the December of 168 BC when Antiochus returned in frustration from Alexandria, where he had been turned back by the Roman commander Popilius Lenius, I guess is how you say it, and vented his exasperation on the Jews. He sent his general Apollonius with 20,000 troops under orders to seize Jerusalem on the Sabbath. There he erected an idol of Zeus and desecrated the altar by offering swine on it. This idol became known to the Jews as the Abomination of Desolation, which served as a type of a future abomination that will be set up in Jerusalem sanctuary to be built in the last days. Again, citing Matthew 24, verse 15. I thought quite interesting when we look at this. Let me just break in a couple other things here. And I read there in verse 9 and 10 how he... let me explain a little bit from what their explanation is about the host. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes did not bring the stars or the angels of God down and trample them on the earth. Okay? People reading that, well, then how do you explain verses 9 and 10? Picking up, where is it? At this point, some observations are in order concerning the relationship between the little horn. By the way, there's two little horns. Remember chapter 7, the fourth kingdom? Has a little horn. Now here in chapter 8, we have another little horn, but it's not the same one. A horn from a small one, and this passage, chapter 8, verse 9, and the little horn in the previous chapter, chapter 7, verse 8, the horn in chapter 7 emerged from the 10 horns of the fourth beast, whereas this horn in chapter 8, verse 9, arises from the four-horned beast that represents the third kingdom, the empire of Alexander. Now, since the author of Daniel lays great emphasis on numbers and invests them with high significance, there is no possibility that he could have meant to equate a ten-horned beast with one bearing only four horns. Now, the only really plausible explanation, therefore, is that the little horn arising from the third kingdom serves as a prototype of the little horn of the fourth kingdom, the crisis destined to confront God's people in the time of the earlier little horn. Antiochus Epiphanes will bear a strong similarity to the crisis that will befall them in the prophetic or final phase of the fourth kingdom in the last days, as Christ himself foresaw in the Olivet Discourse. It's interesting. They all understand that. They see that very clearly. I mean, different commentaries will. Coming back here, but in December of 168, he, Antiochus Epiphanes, had Jerusalem again seized by treachery and subjected it to prolonged looting and massacre as he converted its sanctuary into a temple to Zeus. So it continued until that memorable day 3 years later when Judas Maccabeus rededicated the sacred structure to the worship of God, December 25th, 165 B.C. It's interesting, it's 3 years exactly, and you'll see that in the book of Josephus. He gives the date of when it was set up. Chislev 25, again, it was taken down and purified on Chislev 25, 3 years later, and that's in the month of December. That is Hanukkah, and that's why they celebrate Hanukkah to this day. As he goes on here to say, an event celebrated as Hanukkah by the Jewish community ever since. Now, this verse 11 describes how the megalomania of Antiochus will advance to such extremes that he will declare himself equal with God, who is here referred to as Prince of the Host, that is, the Lord of the army of saints referred to in the previous verse. He will halt the regular morning and evening sacrifice, and he did. And in verse 12, Judah's three-year tribulation period, during which the temple would be defiled and prostituted to heathen use, is now described in verse 12. The host of Jewish believers will be given over, quote-unquote, to the oppression of Antiochus, along with or possibly on account of the continual burnt offering because of transgression. and it, the little horn, will cast truth to the ground and perform its works and prosper. This indicates that Antiochus will be successful for that brief interval and will have everything his own way. I'll tell you a little bit about his end. As he left there, when he found out he was not in the area of Jerusalem, when he found out that 3 years later, Judas Maccabeus had defeated the Seleucid armies of Palestine and had cleansed the temple, he was coming back to take on Judas with his army. And guess what? He became sick with ulcers and worms and died. He had fulfilled, God had allowed him to fulfill what he was to do. God also took his life. You might recall in, is it Acts chapter 12, one of the Herods, the same thing, claiming that he was a god, and everything kind of came out of him, and he quickly died. So you don't want to do that. Let's finish the chapter here so we can try to finish early if I can. Let's go to verse 12. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn. And Antiochus Epiphanes is the horn, or the little horn in this chapter, to oppose the daily sacrifice, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this, and he prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that a certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? He said to me, for 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. But you notice there is a little number one and a center margin note. It says evenings and mornings in the Hebrew. Chapter 8 is in Hebrew too, by the way. So 2,300 evening and mornings is actually 1,150 days. Now, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for one thing, has had a problem over the years because they insist on it being 2,300 days or 2,300 years, a day for a year in prophecy. And that really throws things off. That is not what was being talked about here whatsoever. 1,150 days, 3 years, prophetic years and everything. I didn't multiply that out to see what it is. It's very close. Will this be the time that it will that this will take place in the final one before the coming of Christ, that the actual stoppage of an evening and morning sacrifices will be for 1,150 days before Christ returns? We'll have to wait and see. I don't know. It's just an interesting number. We don't have enough information to know for certain. Maybe it's there because we should at least watch. Not draw conclusions on things where we can't do that yet, but just be aware of it. Be aware of the number. Verse 15, now it happened that when I, Daniel, had been seen the vision, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So there must be more than one angel here. And one of them is speaking to Gabriel. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and I fell on my face. Take note of that. When it is an angel, a true, a righteous angel, or in the case where Jesus Christ has also come before them, they always, without exception, fall on their face. When it's a demon, they fall on their back. Now, if any of you have watched Benny Hinn or some of these people try to heal people on TV, they have a man there to catch the person when they get hit in the forehead, right? And which way do they fall, forward or backward? Backwards, you bet. It tells you what power is involved with that. Coming back here again, God's any time it's a righteous, they'll fall on their face. Now, in the case when it's an angel, the angel will have them stand up. You worship God, not an angel. Not so when, for example, Joshua chapter 5, angel in capital A of the armies of God came before him. He fell. And help me out if any of you can remember exactly. He didn't tell him to get up because he was before God. And he told Moses, take your sandals off. and everything when he approached the bush and all of that. Oh, let me go back here now to move along. The point is that if it isn't God through Christ appearing in occasions when he has in the past, they go on their face and they don't get up. When it's an angel, a righteous angel, the righteous angel will tell them to get up. Let's read on here. But he said to me, "Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, 'Look, I am making known to you what shall happen to in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall come.'" That's why I can tell you I know when Christ is going to return. At the appointed time, right? When's the appointed time? Well, even though this, like all prophecies, they are usually dual. They begin with a historical fulfillment, but it's primarily for the latter time prior to the second coming of Christ. And that's what we're seeing here as Gabriel is telling this to Daniel. Verse 20, "The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece," Alexander the Great, obviously. "The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king, Alexander. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power." None of the four, obviously, would be as great as Alexander was. Now, verse 23, "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes." Antiochus was a type of the one that we're now reading about here. He was a type. And we've always, and you'll see that when we get to the 11th chapter, because he comes up once again, the abomination of desolation in the 11th chapter. He is a type of the one that we're going to see in the time of the end that the book of Revelation calls the beast. Different names and different chapters and different visions, but it's talking about the same individual. Verse 24, "His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive, and he shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people." Referring to the Jewish people here is what he's talking about. And because at the time it was given, they were the holy people. And they're going to go into national captivity. It is going to happen once again. Anyhow, coming back here. He shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Whose power? What power? Satan. Yeah, obviously, Book of Revelation spells that out. Verse 25. "Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart." In other words, just like Antiochus, I'm a god. Well, what's going to happen to this individual? We know what happened to Antiochus Epiphanes. He had worms consume him, and he died, coming back trying to overtake Jerusalem again and throw out the Maccabees. Well, Revelation 19, Jesus Christ on his second coming will take this individual and throw him into a lake of fire right there outside of Jerusalem, on the south end of Jerusalem. And the great false prophet and so forth that will be with him. The two, it says in Revelation 19, Christ puts them into the lake of fire. He will destroy them. why? For the blasphemies as well as all the other things that they do. When it says here, he shall magnify himself, what do you mean? Magnify himself above God, that he is God, just like Antiochus did. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. The King James Version actually says, in peace, destroy many, that through pretending peace, he shall destroy many. And I think that's more correct. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Well, obviously, that's the latter days, isn't it? Jesus Christ. And what will the Prince of Princes do? He'll throw him in the lake of fire. That's what he's going to do. "And he shall be broken without human hand." Now, we read that once again in Daniel chapter 11. And in verse 45, the very last verse of Daniel 11, talking about the same individual. And also, by the way, it says that in Daniel chapter 2, that he will be destroyed without human hands. In other words, at the hand of God. And verse 26, so Antiochus Epiphanes at the beginning of the first half of the chapter is a type of this one at the end who will actually be worse than Antiochus Epiphanes. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And so I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterwards, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Well, that's because when he wrote it in 550 or recorded what he saw in 550 B.C., it was hard for him to understand what was going to happen 400 years later for the first time, let alone the last time. All right, we'll stop right there, have a hymn and a prayer, and conclude the service.